I'd like to thank Cagliacissa for doing a lot of the groundwork, the spade work for this talk, because she's done it in the first three talks. You know, she said we were going to be looking in general, then more specifically, then microscopically. And I'm also going to be talking about looking, but in a slightly different way. And I said when we did the exploration, the question and answer in couples, that you kind of need to know the theory before, in order to do the practice. That meditation and what happens in our mind is a very practical thing, but you need to have the theory. And in a sense, you kind of need to hear the theory, do the practice, and then go back to the theory and you understand it the second time, or the 52nd time. So, thanks, Cagliacissa, for setting things up for this third session, fourth session. I want you to just think about when you were about 5 years old, four or five, and about something that you thought was just beautiful. So to your four-year-old self, maybe about that height, it was just beautiful. Can you think of, might have been something sparkly, something like a ballerina, or I don't know, something of your mum's, something in the garden. Yep. Okay. And then I want you to fast forward about 10 years and enter your teens to about 15. So in your bedroom when you're 15, or in your school book, you've got something that you think is really gorgeous. Or maybe it's a someone by this stage. So what's your image of beauty at age 15? And if we now come into the present week, yesterday or today, what have you seen that you found beautiful? It can be just something small, a poppy, a gesture, a smile, or something massive. Okay. So the idea is to just see if your perception of beauty has changed, or has it remained the same? Do you see beauty in the same places as you used to? Going back to being about 15, there was a quiz in Jackie magazine. Did anyone get Jackie? Yeah. And so Cagliacissa asked me to talk about beauty, so I just put the word beauty into the strange computer of my mind, and this is what I came up with. But I've sifted it, Jackie. Yeah, it's only the start. It gets better. So there was a quiz in Jackie magazine, and it said, "Are you?" There were lots of quizzes. It was basically, Jackie magazine was many things, but it was basically how to check you can go out and live your life and be all right between the ages of 12 and 17. It said, are you pretty, beautiful, attractive, or sexy? And the idea was that in your break, you'd sit on the radiator and you'd mark each other, you know. And anyway, it's quite a crude set of categories. Ideally, of course, you'd be, you know, more than one, probably not all four, but you know, at least, you know, if you weren't beautiful, you got to be something else. But there was the idea, why I brought it up is because even then there's the idea of differentiation. There's not just one that, you know, pretty is different from attractive, is different from beautiful, is different from sexy. Yeah, I'm not going to go into whether you should be sexy at, you know, that age. The short answer is no. But just this sense that even at that age, you're judging, you're perceiving. But at least Jackie said there's more than one way to be. You had a choice of four. And at the moment, I'm not sure that young girls growing up, judging from the images I see, have even that choice of four. I'm also, as I've been writing this and rewriting it, I'm just thinking, yeah, a group of women, let's talk about beauty. How many buttons is that going to push? Let's push some of mine. But we'll have a bigger context to look at it in. But just to acknowledge that, you know, we've got... I asked us to look about, to think about what we find beautiful outside ourselves, but there'll also be a, you know, a bit of a trigger of what we find beautiful in ourselves. One thing that happens on retreat, it can happen, it may not happen on this one. Well, two things. One is that as the retreat goes on, it shrinks. There's a point, and I think it's the second sort of supper time or dinner time, as I call it. Suddenly it shrinks a bit because you start recognising faces. So instead of me and a bunch of other people, it's, oh yeah, there's Patsy, okay, and there's Joe. So it gets smaller. And the other thing that can happen on retreat is that people start to look more beautiful. Towards the end of the retreat, the people look more beautiful. And partly it's because we've relaxed. So, you know, the tension at the beginning, the tiredness at the beginning, the, oh my Lord, who are these people? That's hopefully sometimes reduced. But also we've had time, I think, to see people cooking and sweeping up and crying or laughing. And we're gradually getting to see the themness of everybody. So we're relaxing ourselves. Our face is relaxing. Our beings are relaxing. But also we're seeing the whole of somebody. Because that person, because I'm relaxing, you can see more of me. And maybe that's more beautiful than just the kind of the first glimpse. So that's really a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is how we see and how we have the space to see and the time to see. So my upbringing was fairly conventional. School, family, church. And one thing that I think I was really fortunate in was that I was brought up in the 80s. And I was brought up in quite a big city in Manchester, in Salford, just outside Manchester. So there was a lot of things happening. There was a lot of counterculture as well. So there was kind of the mainstream, what was happening, you know, in school, or my parents were Catholic and we went to church every week, if not more. But you know, on the bus would go into town, and then we'd go out through Rusholme to my school, Manchester High School. So I was kind of going through the centre of town twice a day and seeing a lot of different people and going into town on Saturdays. And there was a lot of counterculture. So I was probably about 10 when punk started, but so kind of growing up, there was Two Tone. And I still think I was really lucky to be growing up when the Smiths were in Manchester and the Cure were in Liverpool, and there was lots of alternative ways to look and ways to be. You know, people could be goths or punks, or, you know, you'd have that phase of going around in dead men's overcoats. Didn't have to be dead, but, you know, it was but it helped. It was kind of anti-pretty, it was anti-beauty. I suppose it started with punk. Disco was about, you know, being kind of dazzling and gorgeous, and punk just went, oh, forget that. I'm just going to rip my tights. And it was liberating because I didn't have to conform. Maybe I was conforming in a different way, you know, the right number of buckles on my shoes or my boy t-shirt. But there was definitely a sense that what you thought and what you believed was as important as how you looked. And that I remember at school, you know, there were sort of, by the sixth form, there were lots of different tribes going on a bit. And I didn't have to conform to a sort of blonde tennis playing stereotype. I could be, what was I? I was sort of doing drama and stuff and wearing old men's pajama tops, to my mother's confusion. But there were alternatives to an idea of beauty, and that was allowed, that was permitted. I didn't have to wear a headscarf. I didn't have to wear a knee-length skirt. I could express myself, I could explore. And when I got involved in drama, at that time in the 80s, there was a lot of performance art, performance culture, and I was lucky enough to work at an art gallery in Bristol when I studied there that showed a lot of performance art. And again, it was about inquiry. It was about trying to find something or make something, not having to be beautiful. And I'm really aware that I was shown that as an option, that it was all right to think and to question and to experiment. And in a way, it ruined me for a normal conventional life, which would have been a lot more straightforward. And it's opened up a lot of choices and a lot of freedom. And I'm aware that women, you know, a few thousand miles away, don't have that freedom or that choice. Men don't either, but particularly for a woman to be able to choose what she wears, what she reads, what she does for a living. I'm grateful for that. So this might be a bit of away from beauty, but it's coming towards the idea of finding your own integrity and finding your own beauty. There's a lot of anxiety now. I suppose what I'm saying is I felt free, not entirely free, because I was worried about not being beautiful, but at least there was somewhere else for me to go. And there seems to be a lot of anxiety about fitting into one model, one mode, one size, one shape. And what occurs to me is that anxiety isn't beautiful, but vulnerability can be. Being open and letting yourself be seen, I find that incredibly beautiful. And a privilege. It is a privilege when somebody opens themselves. And I think it's because there's trust there. So people, there have been loads of cliches going through my head. Oh, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I suppose it is. All babies are beautiful to their mothers. And I think babies can be beautiful because they're themselves. They're not trying to be somebody else or something else. And when I was in meditation this morning, I remembered that the beauty of mindfulness is in being wholly present. In that moment, we're aiming to be just in that moment and nowhere else. So that moment then becomes whole. It's a perfect, complete whole, because we're not pulling into the past and we're not pushing into the future. So any moment, any baby, any face can be beautiful if it is simply itself. And I'm using words like simple and integrity, and both of them, simple is about being a complete organism. If you ever did O-level biology, you might remember, you know, you've got a single cell organism, and simple is, I'm making a gesture, Helen, of kind of a roundness with my hands to indicate a globe or something that's whole, a circle. And integrity, again, that's oneness. That's being all one thing, all gathered together. Kalyutissa spoke of iron filings, that mindfulness acts like a magnet around which the iron filings of ourself can gather. And this is what I've thought today, just of the pain of a scattered self, the pain of being pulled in different directions, and being fractured, and how what we're trying to do is to heal ourselves, to become healed, is to become whole, to become one. And when we come back to ourselves, when we come together, we remember. So remembering is almost like putting back together. You know, if you dismember, you're chopping somebody up. If you remember, you're bringing those pieces back together. If you recall yourself to the present moment, you're bringing yourself back. So there's a healing and a return and a wholeness. Now, the problem with that is that we are pulled by the needs of earning a living and raising children and caring for our parents and living in a city. So there's two things going on. There's me saying, let's be present in the moment, let's be whole, let's be healed. And you could be thinking, or I could be thinking, yeah, that's fine. What about the gas bill? What about that hip replacement? There is a culture that says you shouldn't sit still. You should constantly be moving. You should constantly be responding to the calls of others. There's a practical point there, but there's also a practical point that says if you're not strong enough, you're just going to collapse. And then you can't do any of that other work. So you have to attend to yourself. I have to attend to myself. I have to make myself together, literally together enough to go back and be in the world and be with my family and, you know, and cope with stuff. So both those things are happening at the same time. The objective needs of others and the internal needs that you have. And I'm trying to remember what we said when we sat in this room on Friday night and reported in. Whether people said they wanted, I know a couple of people said they wanted to go deeper in their meditation practice. People wanted stillness. But I'm just trying to remember if there was a flavour of people just wanting to come back to themselves, or a bit of space for that to happen. I mean, the point about the retreat is that it is away from the world. We're surrounded by fields and birds and some cows over there. You can't practice this in the middle of the M25. So there will always be an accusation that this is an artificial setting. And it is an artificial setting. But you cannot learn to do this in the middle of everything else going on. And we have to learn to do this to sustain being in the middle of that busy situation. So there's a training, there is a training going on. And sometimes we, Kali Chitta or Varasahaya or Kemi Siddhi or myself might almost apologise for there being a training. You know, when I was doing that workshop, I said, look, I'm sorry, I know this is difficult. I know it's challenging. But actually, it's about training the mind to be still. Kali Chitta used the phrase shepherding the mind. So the mind, its job is to respond, its job is to think. And there are loads and loads of things for it to think about. Helen, I'm moving my arms, I'm kind of grasping the air in different directions to indicate, you know, like stars, things shooting in at you, shooting in at your head. There's lots of things to respond to. And what we're trying to do is develop the stillness to choose what to respond to and to choose how we respond. And that is a training. And I've been, I'm fairly bright actually, I'm fairly quick, but I've been doing this 20 years and I feel like I'm a beginner. I'm further on than I was 20 years ago, but not much. I don't know. Objectively, I know I must have developed something, but subjectively, I feel like I'm a beginner. This is not to discourage you. This is really not for you to go, oh my God, what's the point? I suppose what I want you to know is that I haven't got it sorted. Don't think it's all right for her, because I'm still working at it. And probably if I wasn't working at it, I wouldn't be on this retreat. Talking about this process, doing the process, having to explain what it is to people who are new to it, makes me more conscious of what I'm trying to do. It clarifies my purpose. It encourages me to continue with this training. And it reminds me of the beauty when I see it reflected back in other people. When I see the value of it reflected in other people, that reminds me of the value for doing it for myself. Slightly off topic, but there you go. So we're retraining our eyes and ourselves to be still. And we're encouraging ourselves to be patient. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, has a lovely image. It's a story, actually. He was looking after a couple of children and they were out playing and it was a hot day and he poured them some apple juice. And it must have been made from real proper apples because it was quite cloudy. And one of the kids went, oh, that's all cloudy. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, well, if you just wait a bit, then it'll settle and the sediment will fall to the bottom and the juice will become clear. Just, you know, give it a minute. So sure enough, he gave it a minute and the juice settled and it was all clear and that was fine. And then a bit later in the day, Thich Nhat Hanh said, oh, I'm just going to go and sit for a while. And the little kid said, right, like the apple juice, you're going to settle and then you'll be clear. And Thich Nhat Hanh looked at the little kid and went, yes, just like the apple juice. So, I don't know, I think of that. Now that's what I'm doing, I'm just letting things settle in order to be clearer. And also when I am cloudy, to know that's okay. I can just settle again. It is not in my nature to be cloudy or to be clear. They're just things that happen. Agitation happens to the juice, or stillness happens to the juice. I was also thinking about so we're talking about, you know, the training of stillness and what the training establishes. And that clarity, I had a link in my head of of clarity is something you can rest upon, stand upon, because it's true. You can trust it. And that brought to mind the poet John Keats in his Ode on a Grecian Urn, when he says, "Truth is beauty, beauty is truth. That is all you need to know." And I must have studied the poem at school, but I thought, what's beautiful about the truth? Shouldn't beauty have an element of being constructed or sculpted to make it look symmetrical? But that would be pretty. That wouldn't be beautiful. And the beauty of truth is that you don't need to question anymore. You don't need to push it. You don't need to keep asking questions. You can place yourself upon it. There's a word in Pali that we use to describe faith, but it's not entirely faith. It's like a faith confidence. Just going to do a little side thing. So there are three different types of faith. There's blind faith, where you go, okay, yeah, he said that, yep, that's fine, I'll trust him. But the Buddha said, no, don't do that. Don't take even my word for it. Don't take even the Buddha's word for it. Test it. Test my teachings as the goldsmith tests gold in the fire to prove that it's true. So you're not just taking it on trust, you've actually got confidence that the teachings work. And then there's another type of faith, which is a yearning, a longing that you want something. But it's that middle kind of faith where you've got experience that it's practical. And the word for that faith confidence, is Shraddha. And another translation or a way of looking at it is placing the heart upon. I'm now making a heart shape, Helen, with my hands, and I'm placing my heart upon. So you place your heart upon something that you know to be true, and that's then your foundation. From that, you can grow. So you don't, when you find something that's true, you don't stop loving, you don't stop making mistakes, you don't stop feeling grief, maybe even causing grief, but you can stop searching. And you've found a place to grow. And you're growing in your own way. You're not growing. I'm not going to grow like Alma. I could try really, really hard. I'm not. Sue's not going to grow like Tori. You know, Tori is going to be Tori. And Jenny is going to be Jenny. So we're all going to grow, but we're not going to grow into each other or as each other. I think it's Oscar Wilde who said, "Be yourself. Everybody else is taken." If it's not Oscar, that one's on me. Anyway. So the Buddha, or some of his disciples, said something similar. This is from the, but a bit longer, so make yourself comfy. So this is from the Lotus Sutra. That was probably written in India, and then it was translated into Chinese in 250 of the Common Era. So I'm guessing 250, Common Era. Would there have been Romans around here? Probably. Yeah. It's been translated a lot since then, but it's very important in Chinese Buddhism. But it came from... It came from India, and because it came from, well, maybe because it came from India, but it's got lots of different stories in this thread, this sutra, and one of them is the parable of the medicinal herbs, or plants, as we call them in Manchester, and that's just for you, and. One thing to bear in mind, I'm reading it today because it's about growth, it's about individual beauty, and it's about rain. So that's appropriate. But just bear in mind that in India, in some places still now, but definitely then, agricultural community dependent on your crops and also very, very hot. So in the hot season, there is no rain. If there's no rain, there's no crops. If there's no crops, you're not going to eat. Your neighbours aren't going to eat. Your families aren't going to eat. Your tribe's not going to eat. So when the rains come, that is really, really important. It's not like, oh, that's irritating, I've got to cancel the camping trip. It's like, hooray, we need this rain. So the rain is a very, very good thing. Anyway, the Buddha's talking, and this sutra is one where people are saying, oh, that reminds me, and they tell a story. And then someone says, yes, and that reminds me of that, and they tell another story. So this is one of the stories in the middle. Okay. So the Buddha says, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, Kashyapa, you should understand that it is like a great cloud that rises up in the world and covers it all over. This beneficent cloud is laden with moisture. The lightning gleams and flashes, and the sound of thunder reverberates afar, causing the multitude to rejoice. The sun's rays are veiled and hidden, and a clear coolness comes over the land. Masses of darkness descend and spread. You can almost touch them. The rain falls everywhere, coming down on all four sides. Its flow and saturation are measureless, reaching to every area of the earth, to the ravines and valleys of the mountains and streams, to the remote and secluded places where grow plants, bushes, medicinal herbs, trees large and small, 100 grains, rice seedlings, sugarcane, grapevines. The rain moistens them all, and none fails to receive its full share. The parched ground is everywhere watered. Herbs and trees alike grow lush. Whatever falls from the cloud is water of a single flavour. But the plants and trees, thickets and groves, each accept the moisture that is appropriate to its portion. All the various trees, whether superior, middling or inferior, take what is fitting for large or small, and each is enabled to sprout and grow. Root, stem, limb, leaf. The glow and hue of flower and fruit. One rain extends to them, and all are able to become fresh and glossy. Whether their allotment of substance, form, and nature is large or small, the moistening they receive is one, but each grows and flourishes in its own way. And the Buddha goes on to say that he is like the rain. He appears, he rains the rain of the Dharma, the law, the teaching, that has but one flavour. It's the same rain, law, Dharma, teaching. But everybody, Elaine, Patsy, Leslie, Catherine, takes it differently according to their needs and their temperament to become fully and perfectly themselves. So the beauty is of potential fulfilled. The beauty is of having enough, of being sufficient, of being fully yourself. There's just talking about the beauty of enough. We talk about Kalyanamitra in the Triratna movement, and it means spiritual friendship, but literally it's a beautiful friendship. Kalyana is beautiful, lovely, auspicious. Mitra is friend. Mitrata is friendship. And what's beautiful about it, I think, is about growth. I think it's about helping that person grow and moving towards what's most beautiful. So it's a moral beauty. But moral beauty is expressed sometimes in physical beauty as well. The Buddha rupas that we have, as Kalitusa said, the Bodhisattva figures are represented as being a 16-year-old youth, because that's meant to be the height of beauty. I guess 16 was probably middle-aged in their times. But it's not the physical beauty that's important. It's the beauty of your action, the beauty of your thought, the beauty of your word. And that's what we're moving towards in Kalyanamitra. And there's something, I just want to say, there's something about being sufficient. I don't want us to get into an idea that there's a model that we must reach where it all looks the same. I'd like us to think about our individual potential, our individual openness and fullness. And within that word Kalyana is the root Kalya, as in Kalya Chitta. And Kalya means lovely, beautiful, but it also means healthy, able, wieldy, as in well-fitting, enough, sufficient, well-designed, perfect for its job. We have dukkha in Buddhism, suffering or discomfort. And in a way, dukkha is the opposite of Kalya, because dukkha is the ill-fitting chariot wheel. You're going over the road and it jolts you, it bumps you, it jars you. But Kalya is smooth, flowing, perfect, complete, right for its purpose and right for the moment. So whatever happens in the next few moments, in the next few days, and a day can last a very long time on retreat, I hope that you find some moments that are beautiful and complete and perfect in themselves. And part of the beauty is learning to see when enough is enough and just what's sufficient in that moment. That's it. Thank you.